This is Robotic Disclosure, the podcast that reveals everything you want to know about robotic surgery, robotic technology, and how to run a best practice program for your hospital, your surgeons, and your patients. I'm your host, Josh Feldstein. Support for Robotic Disclosure comes from Kava Robotics International, the leader in robotic program consulting, serving hospitals in the U.S. and around the world. Visit kava-robotics.com. This podcast series takes our listeners on a journey into the operating room, the hospital C-suite, the industry boardroom, the surgeon lounge, and more. Our guests are going to tell you about robotic surgery, about current and emerging robotic technologies, and how to run a world-class program for your patients, your surgeons, your hospital, and your community. I'm your host, Josh Feldstein. Our next guest is Dr. Rick Fiennes, a man who really knows how to train surgeons. Dr. Fiennes trained in general and cardiothoracic surgery at the University of Rochester, where he served on the faculty until 2005, before joining the faculty of UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill as a thoracic surgeon, professor of surgery, and medical director of perioperative care at UNC Hospital before his recent retirement. Dr. Fiennes is a national leader in simulation-based training for surgery residents and served as a principal investigator on a $1 million multi-institution grant from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the largest study of simulation-based surgical training to date, and which clearly demonstrated the advantage of simulation-based training in improved skills and safety in cardiac surgery. Rick serves on the advisory board of the Institute for Surgical Excellence and is also co-founder and scientific advisor to Kindheart, a unique company that delivers truly amazing and realistic technology for abdominal, thoracic, and cardiac surgical procedures, which he'll tell us much more about. Dr. Fiennes has served on the board of directors of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, the Joint Council for Surgical Education, and the Thoracic Surgery Foundation for Research and Education. And I'm probably missing half of his distinguished resume. Welcome to the show, Rick. We're really looking forward to our discussion today.
Thank you, Josh. Happy to be here.
Let's get started with some absolute musts. When we think about surgeon training, and this is something that you've spent years of your life focusing on, what do you consider absolute musts with regard to bringing a robotic surgeon forward in the most advanced and qualitatively thoughtful way?
Well, I think that the most important thing with regard to surgeon preparedness really is the absolute that the training must prepare the surgeon to do the operation in an acceptable manner prior to starting clinical work. Like so often in today's environment, a lot of that work is done after the surgeon, unfortunately, has started clinical work. And that this training process must include the basic principles of deliberate practice and component task training. And part of that also is that we must have very good assessment tools so that we know when a surgeon reaches the point at which he or she should then start on patients.
Can you define for our listeners a little bit more about deliberate practice, what the definition of that is and what that translates into in terms of actual skills?
Right. Well, deliberate practice is a little bit different than what many people might think of it. It was proposed by a psychologist from Florida State University who really has made his whole life His whole life's work has been based upon how people achieve excellence in skills, be that musicians or athletes or whatever. And what he discovered was they all trained using what he called deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is different. It requires the participant to over and over again do components of an overall task. So, for example, in robotic surgery, that might be nothing more than just docking and undocking. But they do it in a repetitive fashion. It requires a constant oversight from an experienced coach who can correct things. And it also requires the ability to get out of one's comfort zone, to do things that would expand the surgeon's overall capacity to do something. If you just stay in your comfort zone, you can practice it over and over again, but you won't get any better than what you're doing. So deliberate practice is sort of over and over again, shooting free throws over and over again, or you can use various sports analogies, but it's really repetition in a controlled environment that leads to excellence in that performing of that skill.
Thank you. And you're also describing breaking up the components of the surgical procedure in a way that the surgeon can then focus on areas that are less comfortable or more challenging, or where the skill set is perhaps not as strong or fluid as it needs to be. So then the surgeon can take a step or two back and start working on more essential or more foundational type things. If in your experience, a surgeon takes the time in a simulated environment or a non-live clinical environment to accomplish all this, what happens to the surgeon's learning curve? How does that affect cost effectiveness? How does that affect quality?
Right. So we have a fair amount of experience with that, and actually did a 3-year study in cardiac surgery using the cardiac surgery simulator that was financed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and Research. And what we found was that you could take a large complex procedure, for example, an aortic valve operation or a coronary artery bypass, break it down into its component tasks, train using the principles of deliberate practice over and over again so that these component tasks were mastered. And what we found in our assessment tools is that people, as you might expect, rapidly got very, very good at the each component task. We then took those component tasks in the last 3 weeks, and we combined them back together into the entire procedure. And what we found at that point was that initially the component task quality dropped off a little bit because it was in the context of all of these other tasks. But then it rapidly even exceeded what it was doing in the component tasks setting and the full procedure setting. They were able to do that much, much better. Now, it's been difficult to necessarily translate this over into to see what the translation is into the clinical area with hard data, but we have a lot of anecdotal data that the residents and the trainees who do this learn how to do the operation much better and much, much quicker in the clinical arena. And what happens basically is that learning curve that we subject our patients to when we learn a new procedure ends up moving to the left, and there are far fewer patients that have to be subjected to that level of surgery prior to reaching expertise.
This is a completely different paradigm than most institutions follow, and it sounds like, frankly, most institutions aren't even aware of this degree of specificity relative to training. When administration of hospitals hear about this, Rick, and chairs of robotic programs or directors of surgery hear about this, what is the usual response to this type of an approach?
Well, quite frankly, they all understand the concept. They all understand it, and no one certainly can argue with the fact that a surgeon needs to be prepared, completely prepared before he or she starts to do clinical work. So they understand that. But the adoption of the discipline necessary, both from a credentialing standpoint and from the surgeon's own standpoint, to get this done has been somewhat of a challenge. There are economic issues involved. The surgeon would have to come offline. He or she is not generating any income for themselves or for the hospital during this type of practice. So the paradigm, as you well know, in the past has really been what I would consider most people not nearly enough training, and then sort of going into the clinical arena and picking up the rest of the expertise you need in the clinical arena on patients. So we're still working quite strongly with insurance companies and with administration. Some are more enlightened than others to get to the point where there are certain credentialing standards that must be met prior to starting clinical work. And I think the hospitals, I think, are going to come to understand what we have already shown, that the surgeons can do it better and faster and more economically on patients if they've already learned how to do it in the simulated environment.
When you think about putting pressure on hospital administration to move the ball downfield on this, you talked about credentialing as an example of what needs to be mandated to make something like this happen. Where are we relative to government agencies putting their eyes on this process, saying, wait a minute, are we going to leave it to the hospitals to police their own? Are we going to leave it to the medical societies just to put a policy out there that may or may not be followed? There may or may not be compliance. Where are we with JACO, FDA, and other government bodies looking at this to opine on whether and to what degree hospitals and hospital administration will simply have free rein in terms of either doing this or not doing this?
Well, I think that there hasn't been very much of that coming down from the top. And quite frankly, I think that the entire profession, surgical profession, or the area of surgery would be better served if we policed our own than if it was inflicted upon us by some third party. There is a requirement from the Joint Commission that you have credentialing and that it look at certain things and this and that. But there isn't any follow up in terms of the quality of what that is. So I think that my guess is that the pressure may come from the public. And the pressure will come from insurance carriers. Certainly, the risk to the patient is decreased the better the trained the surgeon is, and I think those forces are going to come to bear. We could also hope that residents during their residency will become more accustomed to simulation as a pathway to excellence, and when they get out into practice and they are adopting new technology, new procedures such as robotic or whatever, that this is the pathway that is acceptable to them rather, and that it would not be acceptable to them to do this on patients.
That makes a tremendous amount of sense. I'm sure nobody would disagree with that. And when you think about simulation, maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the approaches to simulation currently as it applies to robotics and minimally invasive surgery, or even open surgery for that matter. I know you've been involved with this for many years, and I know in your capacity at Kind Heart, you guys are doing some fascinating work. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Certainly. So the simulation area, robotics, first of all, lends itself quite readily to simulation, much as the airline industry has. There are a number of different types of simulation that have been used in robotic, starting with the synthetic, just using the robot on synthetic, very rudimentary simulators. Moving rings from peg to peg and that kind of thing. That seems to be pretty good for understanding the clutching and the camera zooming in and zooming out and changing instruments and things like that. The fundamentals of robotic surgery, which is now available, also uses validated synthetic things to kind of teach these skills. And then the next step up is really the virtual type of simulators. I don't want to call them video games because these are far, far advanced simulators, some that are even simulations of entire procedures, and you actually do that. So that those two things, and then of course there's been a simulation on live animals, mostly pigs. But there are problems with all of those, and I think as a surgeon, as surgeons, we would all agree that playing with synthetic things just doesn't really give us the feel and the confidence, and quite frankly, the technical skill to be able to have confidence that we can do it on a patient. The virtual is very good; the anatomy is there, but tissues don't tend to behave the same in the virtual as they do. So Kindheart has, for the last, my lab has been working for probably the last 10, 12 years, and Kindheart now has been in existence for about 5 years, to provide a real tissue experience comparable to a live animal without needing live animals. And basically, we take animal tissue of the appropriate type. We're able to preserve it for a prolonged period of time. With just refrigeration, and then it is reanimated appropriate to whatever the simulation needs, and then placed in a humanoid type environment. So, for example, our foregut simulator basically is essentially the same as what one would do on a live pig. The tissue reacts the same, and it allows the surgeon to either do component task training or to do an entire procedure with the sort of the confidence that the tissue kind of moves the same as in the human. Energy is used, cautery is used, tensions and such. As you know, robotic haptics is a learned phenomenon, and you can learn that on this tissue because it's so close to human tissue. So that is sort of what we've found, and I think gradually, as those people who've been using live animals have seen our work, and also the other ones, they've realized that there's it is able to replace the live animals in most every instance, and it also provides an excellent transition from the virtual before the clinical work has to start.
This is fascinating technology, and I think as a practical add-on to that, when we speak to surgeons, they're very aware of the learning curve when it comes to robotic surgery. I don't know that administrators, or for that matter, patients, consumers, are in any way aware of this. And when you think about the learning curve for any surgical procedure, Rick, we're talking about robotic surgery, obviously, here on Robotic Disclosure. But the learning curve takes 25 cases. It takes 50 cases. It takes, in some reports, 100 cases, whatever the case may be. That's a lot of cases for surgeons to be learning, quote unquote, in a real patient environment. And not only is there a safety risk, a quality risk, but there's also a significant cost risk, because you have tremendous additional supplies. Case times take very, very long. The patient is exposed to all kinds of environmental elements that inefficient surgery does not present to the patient. So if you could speak a little bit to this, when you have a technology, so whether it's virtual combined with Kindheart, what does this do to compress the learning curve? What does this do to increase the quality of the surgery faster? If you could speak to all of this, so this is a fascinating angle.
Well, you're quite right about the effects that a learning curve has on a clinical operation. We found this when I was head at the University of North Carolina, was operating, when I was the medical director of their operating rooms. And what we would find is that operations that ordinarily should take 3-4 hours were taking 6-7 hours because the surgeon was being very careful and very deliberate learning the operation in an environment where he or she did not want to harm the patient. But the end result was that if, for example, you say that an operation is going to take 7 hours rather than 4 hours, you essentially have your robotic capacity when that happens. So it's extremely inefficient, and we had definite capacity issues as various surgeons learned procedures. And as robotics goes on, that's going to become even that process is going to have to come under even more and more scrutiny, because particularly for the practicing surgeon, there isn't, like with a resident, an attending surgeon that can take over and speed it up or anything. You have to kind of go with what your own speed. So we found exactly what you said: the instruments, the frustration of the staff, the length of time that it was taken. I don't know that we necessarily nailed down outcomes in terms of the patients. I would hope the outcomes were the same, but we certainly know that the longer surgery takes has been associated with poor outcomes. By doing these operations over and over again in a controlled environment with coaching, being able to stop and start and take it apart and look at what you've done and everything, we believe that the learning curve can be significantly shortened. So if it's 30, maybe it would end up to be 10. I don't think you can eradicate it completely, but nor do I think that there's any surgeon who, given a choice, would prefer to be learning this on patients if he or she could learn it in an environment beforehand. So, and one of the things about the Kind Heart model is that it includes both a patient bed aspect of it, and it's essentially the same as in the operating room. So the ability to train teams in the bedside assistant, in setting up the robot and setting up the tables and everything, that all can be done. That all can be done within the context of the full operation. If you're going to do a robotic bariatric operation, for example, the surgeon's doing the operation, but the whole team has to be involved to get that done on our simulator, just as they would on a patient. So the opportunity to train is very, very great in that environment. One of the challenges that has come up is the fact that there aren't a lot of training robots around. Some simulation centers have robots that are dedicated to training, but most centers, including University of North Carolina, do not. So the question is, how do we get the access to these robots? And we at UNC. Had our epidemiology group, which is one of the leaders in sterilization, sterile environment, and the sterile OR environment, go over the safe procedures to be able to use the real tissue simulators with the clinical robot in the operating rooms after hours and on weekends, and we have come up with a policy that allows for real tissue and this fidelity of training to occur after hours in the operating room, which is essentially going to expand the number of opportunities, the number of centers where these opportunities are available, to 6,000 or 7,000 from just the few robotic simulation centers that have robots now.
Wow, that's really incredible. Rick, is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
One of the things that Kava brought to us at UNC really was the ability to look at what we were doing. I mean, we were one of the first people to do robotic hysterectomies, one of the first to do robotic prostatectomies, and thought we were really, really pretty good, and we were kind of plugging along and everything, but it was a delusion. And I think that what Kava was able to show by Kavalytics and stuff was to bring to us what the reality was, and not only what the reality was, but a pathway to get to get to the level that we needed to be at. And I think that's a message that needs to be out there. I think without the ability to look at what you're doing with data that is believed and scrubbed and well analyzed, be it video or through Kavalytics, I think is an important part of making a program an outstanding program. I mean, I really do firmly believe it's been a dramatic improvement in the overall quality, and also to set the culture of improvement. You know, as you recall, when we started out, there was a lot of suspicion of what Kava meant and what they were really trying to do, and all that's sort of gone away, and everybody just kind of plugged along to make things better. And to have that culture alone is tremendously worthwhile.
We've been speaking with Dr. Rick Fiennes, a national leader in simulation-based training for surgery. If you have any questions for Dr. Rick Fiennes or would like to share comments with us, we'd love to hear from you at roboticdisclosure@gmail.com. You've been listening to Robotic Disclosure. Support for Robotic Disclosure comes from Kava Robotics International, the leader in robotic program consulting, serving hospitals in the U.S. and around the world. Visit kava-robotics.com. Robotic Disclosure is produced at Northfire Recording Studios in Amherst, Massachusetts. Theme music by the Verve Jazz Ensemble, verve-jazz.com.